Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, February 4th, 2022. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me again with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So at the end of last year, Andrew, you questioned whether 2022 would turn out to be a year of the lawyer for the publishing industry. And so far, it looks like that is the case. Pardon the pun. Let's start with the PW scoop this week, revealing that agents and publishers are receiving subpoenas for information in the Department of Justice's bid to stop the merger of Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster. Interestingly, the subpoenas are coming from both sides in the litigation.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a great scoop. I think no one should be surprised, though, right? I think this is what many in the industry sort of dreaded once we heard the news that the DOJ was going to act to block this merger. And that is finding that, you know, they were themselves, people in the industry, were going to be pulled into the legal fray. And as my colleagues Jim Milliot and Rachel Deal reported this week, both the Department of Justice and Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster have begun issuing subpoenas to publishers and literary agents seeking information about book deals, in many cases, going back a number of years. So our sources at PW tell us that the subpoenas are looking for pretty detailed information about mostly the bigger deals that the houses and agencies have been involved with. Most sources cited information on deals for books that drew advances of around $50,000 or more. The DOJ, meanwhile, is said to be looking for deals going back to about 2019, while the publishers are said, in some instances, to be looking at agreements going back as far as a decade. It also appears that Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster have sort of divided the responsibility of sending requests to different publishers and agents because it's all one case. Why would they duplicate their efforts, obviously? And for the DOJ, I think it's sort of seen as a shift in how they have interacted with the publishing community so far, which until this point has been largely as a fact-finding mission, right? The DOJ has been conducting these sort of informal meetings with industry members trying to learn about industry practices. But with litigation now on tap, subpoenas are starting to fly. And of course, this is how we get information into the court record, right? Part of the discovery process, a process that is supposed to end sometime in mid-April.
And so who exactly are the targets? The other big five, the larger of the indies, agents of major deals? Who's getting pulled into this?
Well, so far we've been told that as many as 30 publishers have received subpoenas. And while it's only a relatively small number of literary agents so far who have received them, that number of publishers is really sort of eye-opening. And we're not exactly sure if more subpoenas are forthcoming or if that's it for now, if they've served all they're going to serve. Sources at the agencies told PW that their discussions with the DOJ often included explanations about what happens when offers for a single project come in from different imprints at the publishing houses.
And so getting a subpoena isn't something that makes anyone's day, Andrew. So how are agents and publishers reacting?
No, you're very right about that. And certainly no one is happy about being pulled into this. You know, pulling documentation and giving testimony can be costly, and it's serious business. You have to hire a lawyer. You know, you can't just be like, oh, I think this is right. Here you go. Some agents and publishers say that the subpoenas that they've received are too broad and that they're seeking really sensitive information about how business is conducted. Penguin and Random House and Simon & Schuster, we understand, have sought to assure agents and publishers that all the information obtained by the subpoenas are going to be subject to a protective order and that they're only going to be seen by the publisher's outside counsels. In other words, that you know, no one at either publishing company is going to get any kind of advantage from looking at or accessing this testimony, this material. But still, that's cold comfort to a lot of people here because things still can come out. We know this. Things are leaked all the time. Things are released all the time. And you know, beyond the costs and time that this whole episode is requiring, agents and publishers say that opening up their private correspondence, for example, really makes them uneasy. And a few agents told us that, you know, look, the nature of the book business can make it even look like completely above board conversations, for example, in which an agent might counsel an author to sell their book to one editor over another for a certain reason. This can be really sensitive stuff. So it's fair to say that the people that we've spoken to at Publishers Weekly, all of whom spoke to us on condition of anonymity, described the requests as costly, time-consuming, intrusive, and a little bit worrying. And the universal feeling is that, you know, this is both from people who are for the merger or not opposed to the merger, and those who are against it, you know, opposed to this merger. The general feeling we're getting is that being pulled into the legal fight is just a headache. So, you know, we can't confirm this 100% either, but we also understand that at least Penguin Random House is offering to cover some of the legal fees that are being incurred by literary agencies, though it's worth noting that offer is not apparently extending to other publishers. Sources have told us that Penguin Random House is trying to keep the situation as painless as possible, especially for agents and for obvious reasons, because agents are regular business partners for these publishers. But you have to remember, too, that this deal, this merger between Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster is pretty unpopular with a lot of agents and other publishers, and certainly with authors already. So, you know, being forced to weigh in and have to hire a lawyer, you know, at some cost and some risk, it's just not sitting well. But again, I would stress here that none of this is unusual. It is part of the process. And the takeaway that I get here is that Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster are preparing a vigorous defense of their deal. And we'll soon see exactly how much the government really does know and understand about the publishing business. And one other thing I'd point out here, too, is that Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster really do understand the publishing business and really do know what information they're asking for and how to interpret it. So I'm not sure the DOJ does, judging from their initial complaint, but we're going to soon see if the government really does know what it's talking about, whether it knows what to make of the information it gets, and what its case is going to look like. So definitely something to keep an eye on as this case heads to court.
Well, as it heads to that court, we head over to another court, Andrew. After our podcast aired last week, the Association of American Publishers filed its reply brief in its own lawsuit against the state of Maryland over that state's library ebook law. You wrote about the brief for PW, so give us your sense of the AAP's argument.
Yeah, so it's January 28th court filing. You can read about that on the Publishers Weekly site. That's now in the books. The case is now fully briefed and ready for its first hearing. And in that reply brief on January 28th, lawyers for the Association of American Publishers pretty much just doubled down on their claim that Maryland's library ebook law is clearly, obviously preempted by the Federal Copyright Act. And it urged the court to, well, two things. One, to deny the state's motion to dismiss the AAP complaint. And two, to grant the AAP's motion for a preliminary injunction that would block the law. Now, both of these are going to be argued at that hearing on Monday, which is February 7th. And, you know, I guess I should back up again because I never know how up to speed we all are on these legal cases. They can be complicated and they move pretty fast. But I'll remind listeners what's going on here and what's at stake. The bill in question, the library ebook law, passed the Maryland General Assembly unanimously last March. And it basically requires that publishers that offer to license ebooks and other digital literary works to consumers in the state, that's pretty much any consumer in the state that can buy an ebook, well, those publishers also have to license those works to public libraries on reasonable terms. Now, offer to license those works to public libraries on reasonable terms. That is something that could come up in the case here. And of course, the law comes after years of discord in the library ebook market, you know, more than a decade, and is a direct response to Macmillan's 2019 embargo on new release titles in libraries, which really sort of brought this issue of equitable digital access to the attention of lawmakers, not just in Maryland, but around the country in a really impactful way. So make no mistake, the law in Maryland and similar laws that are simmering in other states are a direct result of that Macmillan action. And it's important to be clear about this because libraries have long expressed concerns about prices and equity of access to digital content. But if it wasn't for that embargo in 2019, we're just not in court. We're just not here. I firmly believe that. Anyway, this state law solution to the library ebook issue has clearly not pleased the Association of American Publishers. On December 9th, they filed suit insisting that the law is clearly preempted by the Copyright Act because it infringes upon the exclusive rights of copyright holders to control distribution. And despite Maryland's characterization of the library ebook law as a consumer protection statute, the AAP says, look, this measure clearly operates as a state-mandated licensing scheme and one that obviously conflicts with the exclusive rights grants under copyright. Now, Maryland attorneys in their motion to dismiss the case have countered that the AAP is totally mischaracterizing the Maryland law, that the bill doesn't interfere with any grant of exclusive rights at issue here. So how to explain that? Well, you look at it this way. When you buy a book, it's understood that you're just buying that copy, right? For your own personal use. You're not buying the rights. You're not buying the copyright to that work. Now, you can give away your book copy or even resell it under copyright law, but you can't publish your own edition of that content. That's the grant of rights that matters here, Maryland attorneys suggest. And that right is not impacted. Now, as for what happens with the product that you buy, the ebook, which is sold by license, which is a contract, which is regulated by the state, Maryland is saying that the state has every right to mandate and to look at and to regulate terms and ensure that terms to these contracts are fair and not discriminatory. I'll quote from their brief here. A copyright does not make a product invulnerable to the regulation of the manner in which it is marketed. So again, they say that this is a straight up consumer regulation matter, not a copyright law. So in their reply this week, the last filing before we head to this hearing, the AAP, well, I got to say, the gloves are off. They sound like an organization that is out of patience, and they argue that the Maryland's characterization of this law is just plain wrong. They say Maryland is, for some reason, seeking to unravel copyright law, and that Maryland's desire to regulate market practices is, in fact, and I'll quote them here, a pretext, and that Maryland only sees unfair practices because of their, and again, I'll quote the AAP reply, they see unfair practices because of their misperception of the meets and bounds of federal copyright law. In other words, paraphrasing AAP President Maria Palante's comments after the Maryland lawyers issued their answer 2 weeks ago, the Maryland AG has badly misunderstood the copyright law.
The parties will be in court this coming Monday. So what do you expect, Andrew?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what to expect, if I'm being honest, right? I don't expect a ruling from the bench, though we could get one, but it just doesn't happen very often, so I'm not really expecting it. So here's what is going to happen. The court is going to be considering two motions. On one hand, Maryland lawyers are arguing that, hey, this obviously isn't about copyright, duh, so toss the case, because the case is, it rests on a mistaken premise. The AAP is arguing for a preliminary injunction, and their argument is this law is obviously about copyright. Duh. It's clearly preempted. We'll prove it, but you don't have to wait for us to prove it. You can see that's the way it is right now from what we're telling you. So you got to block this law right now. It's that obvious. So you kind of see where I'm going here, right? What the judge is going to hear on Monday is each side saying that the other side has it so obviously wrong that you can end the suit now. So in that sense, this could be over quickly, right? Maybe the judge will see it that way too, and we will get a very quick ruling, if not a ruling from the bench, one in a couple of days, because one side may really be just clearly right here. So as much as you can see this case is a fairly complex case about libraries and the digital age and all that, it is very possible that the question here isn't that complex at all, and that the judge can decide it fairly easily. The AAP certainly seems confident in that, and it certainly is a possibility.
As someone who has closely followed the issue of library ebooks, and specifically the Maryland law, would you care to offer odds on the ultimate outcome?
You know, I really can't. I really don't know. I kind of feel like it's a toss-up. I mean, I can see the AAP's argument, and I can see the state's argument. But here's where I am in sort of evaluating how this is going to go. First, the bar to keep a case from getting dismissed, which is what the state wants, is pretty low. So does the AAP have a plausible case that this law should be preempted by copyright? Yes, they certainly make a very plausible case. And unless Judge Deborah Boardman, who's a recent Biden appointee, has more experience with copyright law than we know, it's just really hard for me to see how this case is dismissed at this stage. On the other hand, the bar for a preliminary injunction, which is what the AAP wants, is really high. And a preliminary injunction is an extraordinary measure, right? And especially when it comes to a federal court overriding a state law, much less a state law that passed unanimously. And as I see it at this stage, since the law hasn't even been invoked yet and there's no real material injury to speak of, the AAP's strongest argument is that the law is so clearly and obviously in conflict with the Copyright Act that the AAP is definitely going to win its claim, and that's enough to show irreparable harm, because that's the law, right? The law says that a constitutional injury is, regardless of anything else, any other evidence, any material harm, a constitutional injury is by definition irreparable. That's irreparable harm. But here's the thing too. And our listeners might remember this. The Register of Copyrights, Shira Perlmutter, noted in her evaluation of the Maryland law last August, which we talked about on this podcast, that there just isn't a lot of case law that's exactly right on point here. And while Perlmutter concluded that the law would likely be preempted, those are her words, that kind of leaves room, right? In fact, it clearly leaves room. Saying that something is likely to be preempted is not airtight. So I have to think that maybe augurs against a preliminary injunction at this stage. I mean, if the Register of Copyrights can look at this law and say, you know, only that a court would likely find it preempted, then it would seem to follow to me that a court of law would want to fully hear the case before deciding there is a constitutional injury grave enough to block the law. And, you know, without finding that constitutional injury, like right away, I think the rest of the AEP's case for a preliminary injunction just doesn't feel very strong to me. And that's primarily because, as I mentioned before, the law is in effect, but nothing has changed, right? It hasn't been invoked. The publishers are still selling to libraries. There's no market injury here. And certainly there's no injury here that can't be repaired, right? By money being returned. So, you know, the AEP even admits that most of its clients are already in compliance with the law. So absent a constitutional injury, an obvious ruling on a constitutional injury, it strikes me that there is no irreparable harm here. Could be wrong, but that's just my reading on this. So anyway, where does that all leave us? Well, Monday. That's the hearing. We're going to know a lot more after that hearing on Monday. We're going to know probably soon after that whether one side is definitely right and the other side definitely wrong. And if I had to guess, well, I don't know. I'd say we're looking at more litigation to come, but we'll see.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly Senior Writer, thanks for joining me on the program today.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, as a physicist in the Blackett Laboratory at Imperial College London, Dr. Jessica Wade investigates polymer-based organic light-emitting diodes, and she's published her research in numerous prestigious journals. That's her day job. Dr. Wade also moonlights as a Wikipedia editor and has written over 1,500 biographies of women scientists. When young girls go looking for role models in science, she says, they should find them easily. In a 2018 column for Nature.com, Dr. Wade noted that before someone had raised the point, Marie Curie, who won the Nobel twice in two different fields, did not have her own Wikipedia page. Instead, Madame Curie shared a Wikipedia entry with her husband, Pierre, whom she outlived by more than 25 years.
And on the day that Donna Strickland won the Nobel Prize for Physics, our most recent woman physicist laureate, our most recent Nobel laureate, who is a woman, she didn't have a Wikipedia page either. And not because Donna Strickland hasn't done hugely notable and important science, but because the biography that had been tabled about her or had been written about her didn't fulfill Wikipedia's notability criteria. So you have this kind of ongoing battle between you as the editor and the contributor and the advocate and the passionate person and what the editing community at large deem notable enough to remain on the world's most important encyclopedia.
Writing Women Scientists into Wikipedia, coming on the next CCC podcast. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burrist Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening. Join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.